Are you able to pull up a web page real quick? Can you hit PyCon.org?
Well,
that's
switch it over.
Basically all there is to it. It's really great to have another hardcore conference on the East Coast, and PyCon's a blast.
Okay.
That's about it. So if anyone wants more info, just kind of general stuff, grab me.
What was it, Pi?
Something. Our own, Night Club's own Bob Ippolito, I don't see him here tonight, but he's going to be speaking at it.
So there we go.
Should be cool.
There you go.
That's it.
That's PyCon.
There you go. All right.
Cool. And I can just click it down really easily. Okay. So you're all set?
Yeah.
All right.
All right. So, welcome. My name is John Schaumann, as you already know. And as you can see here, I am here from the NetBSD project. And this is my email address. If you have any questions that you do not get answered today, feel free to email me. There's also a number underneath there for those of you who do know PGP. This is my PGP key ID, so you can identify that I'm actually the person I claim to be, and the key is mine. But today I want to talk about package source, which is the short term for the NetBSD packages collection. Package source is trademarked now by the NetBSD Foundation since earlier this January. And the NetBSD Packages Collection, as you will see, and as George already mentioned, is a framework for installing, managing third-party software on various platforms. Before we go into the details of package source, I do want to talk a little bit about the general concept of software management. And so the general concept of separate package management and what you have to pay attention to when you do actually install software and how to maintain it. Aside from that, we'll go over obviously the features of package source in particular, and then how to use package source, and there are several aspects to it. Package source, as the last couple of letters indicate, is obviously a source-based package management system, but you can also use it with binary packages, which is a little more convenient for many people, for many installations. If you have large systems, it's more convenient to actually handle binary packages rather than compiling everything from source on every single platform that you're using. We will talk about how you build these packages, how you can update packages, and how you can deploy large numbers of binary packages. And of course, at the end, I'm going to give a short little look ahead of a couple of features that are now new in package source that people might be interested in. If during this talk, at any point, you have any question whatsoever, please feel free to shout it out, or raise your hand, or make yourself heard in one way or the other. I'll be happy to answer anything to the best of my capabilities. All right, so let's talk about the general concept of software package management. When you're maintaining your operating system, you do want to distinguish between your operating system software and the third-party software that you install and add on. If you want to deploy your operating system across a couple of computers, then you have to make a distinction between software or files that are shareable and files that are unshareable. Now, what do I mean by that? You have shareable files that are essential components that remain the same across multiple hosts. So if you have one main server that exports a number of directories over to other computers, then you have certain files that remain the same, they do not change. So the other host can access them and use those files, so they're shareable. Often it's possible to mount such files read-only, or such file systems. All the Unix systems, they used to differentiate, they put files in slash /user, for example, or slash /var, and some of them would be very distinct to the local host. Others would be not so distinct and could be shared. Nowadays, it's actually fairly easy to isolate these couple of files and say, okay, I want to have all these files that I know now only local to this particular host. For example, the kernel or files in etc, like sdab or something like that. Something that you would not want to share with other hosts, obviously. But you could have things under user or local, for example, that you share with other hosts. It may overlap with so-called local data. Now, what I mean here when I say local data is not necessarily whatever happens to be in user local, as many of you know that location, but rather than data that is actually local to this one particular host. There are some operating systems that install software into user local per default. The notion of user local would then imply that this software cannot be used on other machines. So it's kind of a misnomer to install software into user local. The way that I treat it, I treat user local as data that is local to my organization. I'm assistant administrator for a school over in New Jersey. So if we have software that is not under any software management program, then that is not part of normal operating system, then I do install it in user local. So I have a distinction between stuff that is local to my site, there are programs and scripts that I write to maintain the sites, I put those into user local, that is local data. There's also unshareable content, and that is data that needs to be individual to each host. I want to give an example, etcsnet, the kernel, for example. There may also be data that changes often that you cannot share with other hosts because you are writing to it. And that also may overlap with local data, depending on how you have your setup. As we talk about these distinctions between what kind of files you have and how you want to set up your environment, you will also see that there are two more distinctions. There is static data and variable data. Now, static data, I mean, it is those are files that once the operating system has booted, do not change. So they may be changed by you as the system administrator, but they do not change by themselves. I mean, there's no application that writes to them, or no user should be able to write to them. Variable data, on the other hand, would be data that during the course of normal operating might change. So, for example, you have files over here in the first one, where you say, okay, we have shareable content that is static. It means once I have installed all my software under this hierarchy, I can export it to other hosts. Other hosts can use it, and that data does not change in the progress. User is one of the regular locations. Opt is another popular application for IRIX systems, for example, or SunOS IRIX systems. So that is data that does not change during normal operations. Unshareable content that is static would be, for example, /boot or /etsy, as I've already mentioned before. That is unshareable because every single host that you boot would have to have its own etsy or its own boot. An example for variable data that can be shared. So you see, just because it's being shared does not mean it has to be static. It can also be variable data. You have raw mail, for example. If you deliver your mail into one partition, other hosts may be able to access it. Mail obviously changes a lot during the course of the day because people read their mail and they read their news, and therefore that is an example for this kind of data. And finally, the last category would be things that, like in varlan or varlog, those are like the little files that applications may actually write to. When you start up and you have, for example, a pip file for a daemon that might write to varlan or varlog, for example. It is something that would be individual to each host, that not necessarily be able to be shared. Now, these are all these different concepts of having all these different distinctions of data, and I'm trying to make a point here that you will see as we go on, because it's very important for software management systems to also distinguish between these data. If you do not get this right, your software management system will not be able to be deployed across a large number of hosts. The software management system should be able to do that and should have its own distinction of this. So you have to be very careful in which location you install files. You install software applications, binaries, you want to install them probably into a location that's shareable and static. But often these software also have their own files that vary during the runtime. For example, page files or log files or configuration files that cannot be shared. So the software management system needs to be aware of this, and you need to understand the concept of this. All right. Now you have your operating system, and you know where all your data belongs. There's another important aspect that says you have to distinguish between system software and third-party software. The reason that you cannot just simply take all the software that you find on the internet and install it wherever you want to is because if you upgrade your operating system and you have put certain things into, for example, a user lib, and then you say, okay, now I'm going to use my operating system upgrade procedure to change this, they might take away libraries that you installed from another source. So it's very difficult, it's very important for you to make sure that you understand this distinction when you're installing software. Similarly, configuration files might get mixed up or might be duplicates. The operating system vendor will probably provide you with certain binary sets that say, okay, I can extract this, and then I have my new version of my operating system. So they might override configuration files that you might use otherwise. So you have to put that software in a different location. We have conflicting or duplicate versions in the base system versus the add-ons. Sometimes your operating system comes with an MTA that you might not want to use. Suppose it comes with sent mail, but you want to use postfix. and PostFix is not part of the operating system. Then you would have the same functionality, but you was going to install it as add-on anyway. There are startup scripts and daemons, of course, that need to be started when the operating system boots. And you have to think about the location of third-party software. And then, of course, there's the proprietary third-party software. It is software that you cannot download and compile yourself, but you have to install it anyway. So these are all these factors that come into play when you think about how you can install all kinds of software as add-ons to your regular operating system. So since we are the New York City BSD user group, we're obviously talking a lot about open source software. And open source software, there are tons of applications there, and usually people always know it's like these three command rules says .configure, make install. Well, okay, sure, you could install everything that you want to install by hand, but you have a lot of problems with that because, first of all, there are thousands of applications and libraries that are available. There's not a single one spot that tells you, for this operating system, there's this software available. If you say, oh, I want to have a news reader, what do? You cannot just say, okay, I'm going to look around on the web and you find one, but maybe you would have found a better one somewhere else. There's not one default, so it's very difficult for you to make a right decision. Binaries are not available for all platforms. That means most open source software on the website, they say, okay, download the software here. And then they say, oh, we have binary packages for. And often what they have is binary packages for Linux on i386 platform, and that's pretty much it. Or they say, here's the software for Unix. And you say, wait a second, which Unix? And then they say, all Unix. And you say, wait a second, how does that work? And you discover that they have a Java installer which requires you to run Linux or something, and so the point is you cannot always have binary packages and just download them. Similarly, if you want to compile stuff from source, you may be running on the platform that while the operating system is supported, this platform is not supported. There's a lot of software that will work fine on i386. But if you happen to be running netbsd/len, netbsd Ionix, netbsd Pax, netbsd MacPPC, netbsd SDIMIP, and so on, any of the other platforms, most often the software is not available in binary format for you, so you have to compile it yourself, which may still work just fine, but it's not available for you right away. All right, so you decide to download the software and compile it yourself. You all know it, as I said, /configure, make install. Unfortunately, it's not always that easy, because this is where Surgeon's Law comes in, and that is 90% of everything is corrupt. That is unfortunate, but it is the case. The majority of the software out there is not so well done. It just happens to be a fact, and you have to deal with it. So if you download the software and you install it, you will notice that, wait a second, this doesn't run, this doesn't compile, this says it needs this, or it needs that library, it needs something else. So it probably won't work out. So you have to fix it. So you have to go and understand the source and see what it's doing and what it's looking for, and you have to configure it yourself. That is not a trivial task. Most of the time, you can probably just get it done yourself. You just download it, you run .configure, it fails, and then you say, okay, it failed because it couldn't find the path to this library. So you pass it the path to the library, and then it fails somewhere else, and so on and so on. But sometimes the software is just written in a shoddy way. Most of the open source software available on the network is on the internet is in general written for Linux. Linux i386, as I said before. They make certain assumptions about certain header files being available, certain libraries being available, and those often are not true. Similarly, they make assumptions about what kind of compiler you're using, what kind of linker you're using. The majority assumes that you're compiling your stuff with GCC, a very popular compiler. But if you're running, for example, Solaris or Irix, you don't want to use GCC. You've got a perfectly fine compiler there, the industry strengths are for this platform. So you do not want to use GCC, and it may fail. And, of course, there are tons of different ways of satisfying dependencies or optional features. Much of the software that you can find when you download it says, okay, if you want to enable sound support, you will need this library. If you want to put in support for graphics, you need these libraries. So there's a lot of different features that you can enable or disable, and you would actually need to know all this stuff to install it. So what you want to find out, you want to find a framework that allows you to do all these things automatically. And once you have all these applications, how do you maintain the set of installed applications that you have? The more applications you have, the more interdependencies you have. You have one application relying on the existence of the other one. If you upgrade this application, it may have an adverse effect on the other one, and so on and so on. Very rather complex dependencies. Start out from there. Let's take a look. For example, let's install some software that produces nice lights. This is something that I use. It's called XPBI Prevent. Alright, if I want to install that, I will have to find out that in order to use that, I need something called LaTeX to HTML. Alright, so I go on the internet, download LaTeX to HTML. Once I go there, I say, okay, I'll compile that. LaTeX to HTML tells me, well, in order for LaTeX to HTML to work out, you need something called GoScript, you need something called NetPVM, and you need TTAC-BIM. So you go around the internet and download all these files and start to compile them and install them. But then when you start with the first one, you notice that every single one of these has other requirements. It says, wait a second, I need PNG, I need Perl, I need TIFF, I need all these other things. This is the complete and sufficient dependency graph for the package XPBI presents. So in order for this one package, I need some 13 packages just to pull that in. Now suppose you have these installed, and then you want to say, oh no, I want to have something else that over here depends on TTAC-BIM. And then later on you want to update something like TIFF library, comes a new version out, there was a security risk or something, you want to update that. Okay, once you remove that, you have to remember all these dependencies. Let's take a look at this. Consider a fairly simple installation, like my laptop. My laptop does not have much software installed, I don't need much software. But let's take a look. Alright, the package info command gives me information about the software that I have installed on my laptop. If I type that into the output of just counting how many there are, I have on my laptop 149 packages. And that is a pretty bare-bones installation. I have a very minimal window manager, not many libraries, just a couple of tools that I use regularly. Alright, now let's take a look at the dependency graph for that. Alright, I have a program here that is part of package source that calculates the dependency between all the packages and hopefully soon will tell us what this looks like. The way it does it, it works its way through actually every single package and reports what it is required, what the other package requires, and from where it goes. So, let's hope it works. Hold on a second. Well, this is a little bit embarrassing. Just a minute, please.
I crashed.
Yeah, well, apparently this, I have to try another time. I just crashed, unfortunately. Of course, always in the best part that you could have, or possibly happen. I'll bring it up again. It's going to take a couple of minutes while I'm loading and everything, and I hope you'll forgive me for that. Just a couple of things here. So at least you get the benefit of seeing how I boot my laptop and all the things that are going on here with NetBSD. You will notice that I'm also using the cryptographic disk, which will later on prompt me for my password here, which we had a talk on earlier. Yes.
Of course. Sure.
All right, in the interest of speed, I'll just abort these. I'll get my display up again. I'll get my DHCP. I'll get on the network. And we're going to be up and running hopefully very soon. And let's see if this doesn't happen again. Thank you. Alright, here the slides. We were somewhere over here. Let's try this once more. We're back in business. So, as I said before, I have approximately 150 packages installed on my laptop, and if you actually draw the dependency graph for that, it looks something like this. Over here, we have Perl with all its myriad of dependents, and somewhere over here, we have some more packages, and over here is a little package that I started out with. So we have LaserTwoHTML over here, we have Glue, Ghost Scripts, we have PNG and all these things, but you see that there are so many more interdependencies. Every single package influences the behavior of another package. If you were just to say, okay, I have to update this one package, it's a nightmare if you have to do it by hand. You actually have to write down which application relies on which one, which library influences which one. So just pulling one out and putting a new one in is probably not a good idea. This, as I said, is just for 150 packages. Now, where I work, as I said, over in the school where we maintain a large number of FPSD machines, I have 1,012 packages installed because many students like to have all a different kind of software. For installation where I have over 1,000 different add-on packages, the dependency graph becomes even more complex. What you see here are so-called leaf packages. That means if you think of a regular graph, they're leaves. They don't have any children. So far, it's pretty easy. But then when you scroll over, there's a couple of dependencies between those couple of machines. But then over here, this is where it gets really hairy. Look at this mess. Oh, wait a second. Down here, you see this package called KDE base. You know, that's not a good sign, because if you know KDE, you know all the things that you have to install to make KDE run, and all the things that belong to KDE. So this one is obviously one of the points of the graph that will have lots of arrows pointing to it, and lots of arrows pointing away from it. And you have on the other side the other remaining leaf packages, just to give you an idea what this looks like. All right. So, I guess you get the idea. You don't want to do these things by hand. You want to have some software mechanism that can do that. Because we as people are lazy, and computers are generally pretty good at doing this repetitive task of saying, okay, I start over here. Let's see what I need for this one. Go over here. Let's see if I update this one. What do I need to do? Computers like to do that. We don't. So, you want to have some kind of software management system that can take care of that for you. So important aspects in general about software package management is, first of all, there is one available for virtually any operating system. Your vendor, your hardware, your software vendor will come with some kind of software install mechanism. You will have for Solaris, you have package tools. For iOS, you've got the Inst thing. For Mac OS X, there's Fink and Darwin ports and all these things. So for pretty much any operating system, there is one package management system. Now suppose you're dealing with more than one operating system and you want to keep all your software at the same level. It's going to be a nightmare too, because then you have to learn, first of all, a couple of different software management tools, and you actually have to make sure that they're all in sync, they're all at the same level. Every single effort of package management just includes either building from source or using binary packages. You want to be easily able to determine what actually is installed. As you just saw me use the package info command, it is one of these tools that can tell you what software is installed. And of course, you can pass it flags to find out what version is installed, where the URL for the home pages, and so on and so on. You want to have something like that. You want to be able to keep track of where things are installed. You don't want to just be able to install stuff, but later on, you also want to be able to say, oh, this file over here, where does it belong to? Which package does it belong to? Let's do the reverse lookup. Once you use package management, you have to make consistent use of this package manager. Otherwise, you're just going to get into dependency hell. That is very frequently seen in RPM-based Linux distributions. There are many Linux distributions. They have all some kind of upgrade system. Often they use RPM. Now, what happens a lot is that somebody says, oh, I need this RPM. And they said, oh, I have a dependency, I need this library. Okay, the vendor from which you got it, say Red Hat, does not have packaged that version that you actually need. So you say, oh, wait a second, there's this company called SUSE, they also wrap their things into RPMs. They have the right library, you download that. You want to install it, the installer says, no, that doesn't work. You say, oh, I know it works through forces. Once you have it forced, you do not know where the stuff actually is later on because it's not registered properly. If you install something by hand to satisfy your dependency, you're equally in trouble because you cannot keep track of where these things are later on. And any software that installs says, wait a second, I need this package. And you say, no, I have it installed from hand. So you have to be consistent in whichever mechanism you choose. Several of these package management systems provide mechanisms for several different depots or package views or something like that, which means the possibility to install versions of the same software in different locations. So if you want to have, for example, Emacs version 20.1, but you also want to have Emacs version 20.2, you can have them both installed at the same time. There may be reasons for that, because some other add-on packages may rely on one or the other, or your users prefer one over the other. If you have a possibility to separate between the two different versions of the same application, that is referred to as depots or views. And you want to be able to teach your users how to use these tools, because otherwise they're just going to come up and bug you all the time and ask you questions. If you can just say, wait a second, you could just run package info, for example. Alright, enough of this. I guess you're all here because you have some interest in the BSD family, and our talk today was on package source. So let's say, what the hell actually is package source? Well, our tool can figure that out. We have a definition. It is called NetBSD Package Collection, the framework for building third-party software in NetBSD and other Unix-like operating systems, currently containing nearly 5,300 packages. It is used to enable freely available software to be configured and built easily on supported platforms. What you see here is, by the way, the stressing of it being available for not only NetBSD, where of course it originated from, but also other Unix versions. So you can actually use the same tools across different platforms to install the same software. And it currently has some 5,300 packages in it, and it's mostly freely available software. Alright, so let's see what platforms are supported by package source. You all know that NetBSD is the most portable operating system, and in the same spirit, package source has been trying to follow that goal too, to be portable to other operating systems. The package source framework was originally developed based on the FreeBSD ports collection, which many of you know too, and it was first put on NetBSD in 1997. Soon after that, it was ported to Solaris. It was then called Zularis, based on the developer who ported it, Christos Zulas. That was because Christos soon discovered that installing software on Zularis is not such a hard thing. You actually want to be using the same tools that you've been used to from your normal machines. So he ported that over. Soon after that came Linux, was the next logical choice. Because, as I said earlier, there are so many different Linux flavors that they all have different versions of their package manager, and even if they call it the same, they're not quite the same. So it kind of makes sense to port it over to this platform too. Also, a lot of software is available for the next, so it makes sense. Then the next one was Darwin, Mac OS X, right away. That was also a logical choice because at that time when Mac OS X came out, and Think was just in its infancy, or Darwin course wasn't even around yet, we started to think, well, we want to manage our software the same way. We decided that Mac OS X is based on BSD, so we want to use the same mechanism. Now, it's, here we already see a couple of interesting differences in the platform. You'll notice that they use a different approach to shared libraries. So the framework has to be adaptable enough to say, okay, I can use shared libraries on this platform and shared libraries on other platforms. Well, FreeBSD was a pretty quick port over right after that, similarly with OpenBSD. But here you notice that there are already people who were not satisfied with the FreeBSD collection or the OpenBSD Plus collection. They said, wait a second, I use NetBSD, I like the package source collection, I use it for Linux maybe, and they have a FreeBSD machine, and they notice, wait a second, I like this, they ported it over. Now here's the one aspect where you have to pay attention, not to be overriding the local tools that they use, because they have tools that use the same names that we use. So when porting that, our infrastructure has to be adapted for that. Iris came there on in 2002. Iris is a little bit interesting in this case because it is much more System 5 based than the other ones. And so there are many things that work a little bit different than on our BSDC derived systems. Another aspect about IRIX is the compatibility between different ABIs. So you have, for example, an IRIX, if you have a 64-bit host, it can run either 64-bit applications or 32-bit applications. If you want to compile software to be the 32-bit, that's fine. But you have to make a decision right away, because you cannot link 32-bit libraries into 64-bit applications, of course. So there's another aspect of infrastructure that had to be adopted for that. BSDOS came in 2003, similarly with AIX. I'm not quite sure what the status of these right now. It is a little less popular than the other ones, but there's support for it. In 2004 came Interix. Interix, for those of you who don't know that, is Microsoft Windows Services for Unix. So they had, it's similar to the Cygwin, if you may know that, it's similar to that, in that it has, offers you a shell and offers you all these Unix interface for Windows, and it's currently a very growing platform. We now have actually people doing what we refer to as bulk builds, which means they try to build every single package we have, and there are several hundred that already succeeded. Now, the bulk builds that we're running runs on every of these platforms. For Solaris, which is a very popular platform, we have about 2,400 successful packages for Solaris. The interesting thing about Solaris that I forgot to mention there is that Sun actually is right now looking into using package source framework internally for their own purposes, and they have recently donated 2 machines for package source development exclusively. So we're very glad about that to see that our efforts are being respected there. And then Dragonfly BSD comes along and we port it to that chip. Dragonfly BSD does not have yet chosen their actual package manager, and there are apparently people within the project who are interested in saying, oh, we want to use package source. We hope they will make this decision and we'll see if we can work with them. And there's OSF1. Oddly enough, only supported 2004 for a rather old operating system, but it's there. So that's a whole bunch of platforms, and there's works for more that we are working on. We have Unixware in progress, I think, and probably more. Alright, so as we talk about package source, we'll have to agree on a couple of terms that we are now on the same page. First of all, package source, very easy, it's an FBSD packages collection, meaning it is the framework that we're using. There's a bunch of files, a bunch of make files, a bunch of make file fragments, shell scripts, and so on that allow us to build the software. The port, in FBSD terminology, refers to a hardware platform. For example, IP86 is a port, MacTPC is a port. In FreeBSD, they refer with a port to what we call a package, which is in the next one. The package we refer to as a set of files and building instructions describe what's necessary to build a certain piece of software. The package is usually stored in user package source, but can be actually stored anywhere. Then we have the binary package, that is the result after you've built the package. The binary package is a set of binaries built with package source from this file or can stuff together in a single .tgz so it can be installed on other machines. And this file is the file, or the files, that are provided by the author of the piece of software that you need to download, that you need to fetch. And those are the main terms that we need to remember. Alright, so package source has a lot of very good features. Some of the more obvious ones are what I've already elaborated to. Obviously, if you want to build from source, you need to fetch the disk file. You don't want to have to download it yourself. So it actually does that. It fetches it automatically for you without any interaction on your part. It will do the dependency checking. So if you go back over here to our little dependency graph, over here, if you want to install XPDI presents, you just go here, you type make, and it will do this whole thing, this whole dance of growing up the tree and figuring out which dependency it will do for you. So that's a very nice feature. It will do the installation of all packages, no dependencies. It maintains the package database, including a checksum of all the files that are installed. That's a very important aspect that comes in later. We will go into detail there. It provides several upgrade procedures, so if you want to upgrade a package because a newer version came out or because a security issue was released, you can automatically upgrade all installed packages, or you can upgrade a single package in all the dependents, or you can upgrade the package in place, which is a kind of risky procedure, but we will go into that too. And of course, all of the above applies to binary packages just as it applies to the source packages. Alright, some of the more subtle features of package source are the ones that really make it strong for system administrators. First of all, we have integrity checking via a recorded checksum. That means if we download the disk file, you must not just extract it and compile it and install it. There might be a backdoor in there. What we do is we download the disk file and we check it against the checksum that we have previously recorded. If there is a Trojan in somewhere put up on the web, we would notice that. We would not install it. We would complain about that. Similarly, if there is just another change, or if during the download something went wrong, there wasn't necessarily a Trojan, but it was just corrupted, it would not even attempt to try to compile it. We check that. We have automatic patching of sources where necessary. So if you download a piece of software that was designed to run under Solaris, and it was ported to NetBSD, then we have these patches and we'll apply them automatically. The way we do the patches is, we don't just say, oh, we don't do it this way in Solaris, we do it in NetBSD, but we port the software. We say, okay, if you are on this platform, you do this. If you are on the other platform, you do that. And then we feed the patches back to the software author. Often they integrate that into their next release, and then we have less maintenance headache. There is a verification of acceptable licenses, which is very good for large and system installations. The majority of the software is available under some open source license. But several of the software that you may install does have certain restrictions to it. There may be only shareware, or there may have certain restrictions on how you can redistribute it. So you can actually check whether or not you wanted to agree to this license or not. There's a whole bunch of different knobs that you can turn, that you can set preferences, and all of that you can do in one central file. You can just put your preferences into etc.mk.com, and package source will always honor these things. The defaults are in package source mk defaults and mk.com. The checking of installed packages against known vulnerabilities is a very important feature. It is, if you have all these different binaries installed, you can run a program that will check every single package against a known vulnerability. We have a list that is released by the packages team that will list every known vulnerability in our software tree. And you say, okay, for example, there is a problem in KTEC bin if it's younger than the release from 2.5, for example. And if you have 2.4 installed and you run this program, you will get a warning. You will get an email warning from the contact. And since early last year, we have actual package source release engineering. Now, as you know, you have all these thousands of different applications, and they release new versions on and on and on. There are new libraries coming out, and new features added to these things. Trying to keep track of this is very difficult. If you have a large-scale installation, you cannot just upgrade any package just because a new one comes out. You want to say, okay, I upgrade if I really need a feature. The package for HeadStack and CVS, this will just be the leading edge. So, you know, you will get, if you follow this one, always the newest package. But that may lead you to upgrade other packages and other dependencies as you go along. But we now have quarterly stable branches. So every couple of months, we actually cut a branch and say, okay, this is the stable branch. We will make sure that this stuff works on your platform. And if there's a security issue, we will apply it. But we will not just pull up all the other new versions of new software. And that is actually very, very helpful for me in my work as a system administrator to be able to have this one target that you can track and it's stable and it does not always change. So it's something you may want to look into if you are supporting more than people than just yourself. Alright, so how do you get package source? There are three ways to get it. It's basically just a big tarball. As we said, package source is a framework consisting mostly of makefiles and makefile fragments and shell scripts. So you can just use it via sub, via CVS, or download it via FTP. This is the tarball that is updated once a week, and so you can get it and download it, and then you can track it via CVS from there on if you like to. On non-NetBSD platforms, we also need a couple of the tools. The package source framework requires a bunch of tools, like it needs an FTP client, so it can fetch the disk files. It needs a digest program, so it can check the integrity of the disk files. It needs to have certain other tools that are all part of the NetBSD-based system, but on other systems, since they may not have these tools, it provides the bootstrap package source framework. And package source being self-hosted, all you have to do is you go thus, once you inspected the tarball into your package source bootstrap, you tap the README, which applies to whatever platform you're using, and then you tap bootstrap, which is a shell script, which will automatically install all the tools that you will need. Once you're done with that, you're ready to use package source. If you want to use package source, you can just use binary packages. Since we continuously are building binary packages, we of course make them available. So you can use the package add command. So you have three different packages that are stored on ftp.netbsd.org and all its mirrors. So you can just set a certain mirror for yourself and install them there. So you can just install package add ftp, this URL, And then over here, now hierarchy, you'll see we have unit R and unit T. This R is the operating system release and the operating system architecture. So if you're a NetBSD MacBPC 1.6, you would say 1.6 MacBPC slash R. This is where all the binary packages are, and you can install them. The behavior of the installation tool is influenced by a number of environment variables that you can, of course, set to your liking. Local base is a place where all the packages are installed. Per default, we install them into user package. Again, you will notice that we do not install them into user local, as other systems do, because of the distinction that we elaborated on earlier. You can set it to any place you would like. So if you want to keep your software in, say, opt package or opt new add-ons or wherever, you just set this environment variable. The package DB here is the place where information about the packages is stored. It's the database of all the packages installed. For default, it is in VarDB package. And then we have this variable called package path, which is a list of directories in which to look for binary packages. Because suppose you want to install something, you don't want to always type this huge long line up there. So what you do is just in the environment variable, you just set package path to include this. Or if you have, for example, binary packages on a CD-ROM, you just say slash CD-ROM slash packages and type package X, and it will install them. Look into every one of those. All right, so that's the binary packages. But as I said, package source framework is building things from source. It consists basically of a whole bunch of make files. So for each individual package, there is, in general, one make file, which has instructions on how to download the software, where to fetch it from, and so on and so on. The disk info, which contains the checksum of the disk file. There may be a couple of patches that you have to apply to, which, as I said, will be applied to automatically. There will be a description, which describes what the package does, and a so-called plist, which is the list of files that are installed. All of this will, of course, later on be registered, but this is what a package in general looks like. Let's take a look at a simple package. This is the rich version of the make file for the package net.tor. Tor is the onion routing. It's a very interesting application. If you want to take a look at it, you can go to tor.net.org. This is what the package source make file looks like. First of all, it tells you the name of the file, obviously, and the version. It tells you what categories this belongs to, so you know in which directory to find it, in which directory to find binary packages. It has a maintainer, that happens to be me. The maintainer field is there so that if a new version comes out, people who do not have access to CVS in the NetBSD repository can send an email to this person and say, wait a second, there's a new version out. Or they can say, could you make it portable on this platform? Well, here are patches. So there's a maintainer field. And there's a home page, a short comment. And then you see already over here this little fragment where it says, it's not empty, package source compiler something something. This is just one of the portable features that says, well, if you happen to be using the Mix Pro compiler, then you have to add a different flag to the compiler. You as a user don't have to worry about that. All you do is just type make and it will do this. So this is something we did already. And we have a way to install it and a couple of including other files to figure out the dependencies. Alright, so let's take a look at this. Let's go there. Alright, so here we go. You will see that it first says checking for vulnerabilities. If there were vulnerabilities known, it would give you a warning and it would say, no, you can't install it, there's a vulnerability. You can overwrite it if you want to, but it would mean that you really know what you're doing. Then, as you see, it fetched the file over there, over FTP. Extracted it, applied the patches, and now it's already doing the configure. It's running there, doing the whole thing. We can let it run there, it's not a big package, while we go on. So the individual steps are, through the bridge version, fetch the disk file, make sure that the checksum matches, and then install all the dependencies. Now, Tor doesn't have any dependencies because I didn't want to run now through a huge package of codes and all the other stuff. But it would do that now and repeat all these steps for each one of them. Then it would extract the disk file, apply the patches if necessary, configure the software, build the software, and once it's done, install the software. Alright, this is still compiling, so I guess we can just let it go. Now, once you have installed the whole thing, you want to say, okay, now I want to build a binary package, because if you have 500 different machines you want to install Tor on, you don't want to do that 500 times on each machine. Instead, what you want to do is you say, okay, I've got this installed, I create a binary package that I put into my repository, and then my automatic mechanism will update the packages in my host, for example. So you want to create a binary package. Again, you just type make package, and that's it. What the make package is, it of course runs make install. First of all, it has to install the software. After it's installed the software, it will create the binary package, including all the files and the meta information in the tarball. And that's all there is to it. The meta information, we can take a look at what that is. Alright, this has now installed. Built.
Yeah.
Alright, here's another little thing. After I finally managed to type the root password incorrectly, you'll see that it says, okay, I compiled Tor 0.0.9.3. Now when I type make install, it says, wait a second, you already have this application installed. What do you want to do? That's something that you cannot do automatically. You have to ask the user. You can delete it and then install the new version. Or you can update it, which means you reload the package and all of its dependencies. Since this is a leaf package, that will not be much of a problem. Or it would have to make replace to replace it in place without relinking dependencies, which is risky, which is why we have this warning there. So now let's take a look at the actual files that are in the package. Alright, in var.db package there is for each application a directory with the name of the application and a whole bunch of files. We have one file called build.info. Build.info contains the information with which this package was built, as the name suggests. So for example, it tells you it was built under NetBSD 2.0 beta on the architecture i386. So if I would take this binary package to NetBSD 1.6 Mac PPC and I type package add, it will tell me, wait a second, you're trying to install an i386 package. So that may not be a good idea. You can override it if you want to, but we probably wouldn't. It tells you a couple of environment variables, compiler flags, how it was built, and all these things. Then you have the build version, which tells you exactly from which files this file was built. Since we have all our files in the CBS, we know exactly which version of the file was last modified by who, and this is also stored in the binary package, so you can figure out exactly which version of which file you have. There's the comment, which is only one line, and over here, that's the interesting part, these are the contents of the binary package. You will see that we have not only the actual files, bin.tor, bin.torify, men1tor.1, but we also actually have the md5 checksums of these. So what that means is that if you take one of these files and you modify it, your binary package later on will know that. It will say, no, you cannot override this. No, you cannot delete this. It has been modified. That may be a security risk, but it may also just be on purpose. For example, if you have a configuration file that you need to edit by hand and you make a change in it, then later on the program will tell you, no, I'm not going to remove this file to change this. That's a good thing because you don't want to have it removed. But as you see, we have the checkbox for all of these, which can later on, I'm going to elaborate on that. We could presumably use this mechanism to build something like Tripwire. You just check every single application on your system against the checksum that you have recorded. Alright, and there's the deinstall script that it actually runs when it does these things, and, you know, a couple of other information about the package, which we see over here, including the description of the package, so that when you run the package info command, it will tell you something about it. Here we go, package info tor tells us the comment, the one line, tells us the long description, tells us the home page. We can, of course, also take a look at what files are there. And there you go, these are the files. Similarly, you can do the reverse lookup. So if you pass it these flags and you specify a file, then it will say which package does this file belong to. So if you, for example, know you have to change this file, you want to upgrade this, but where does it actually belong to, you can just enter it, find out, then go to the right directory and do all your packages. There's magic there. Now, upgrading packages is the most important aspect of the whole package management system. As you saw from the dependency graph, it's a very complex task. The holy grail of updating packages is that during the upgrade process, which does not affect the running system, all dependencies are upgraded as well if and only if it's necessary. It's very difficult to achieve that in reality, because if you start to do these things, if you compile a new library, how do you know which other applications do need the new version and which other application needs the old version? If you just replace it with a new version, how do you know that the other applications you have installed will work actually and accurately with this? Very difficult. In package source, we basically have these three possibilities. You can delete the package, rebuild it, and reinstall it. You can replace a package without rebuilding dependencies, and you can delete a package, remember all the dependencies, and then rebuild all of those. We'll go over each one of these. First, delete a package, rebuild, and reinstall. Okay, if you do it from the package source framework with the make, just type make reinstall, make clean, make install. So you remove the package, you rebuild it, you install it. Or you can do it with a binary path. You can say package delete the package, and then package write the new version that you have. Okay, that's a very simple approach, and it works very well for leaf packages, meaning packages that do not have any dependence. The problem is, this only works with packages that do not have any dependence, meaning it only works with leaf packages. Okay, you can replace packages without rebuilding dependencies. That's the lazy man's work out there. So if you say you want to replace the TIP library, usually what you would think you would have to do is you have to rebuild KDE and GNOME and all the other rest. That takes a long time and you don't want to do that. So you say, okay, I'll make replace. Make replace does the following. It registers all the dependencies first. Then it forcibly deletes the existing package, but it has kept the memory which the other dependencies are. Then it installs the new package, and then updates the dependency list for the new package from what it had remembered beforehand. So that when you're done with this, the new package would still have the list of all the packages underneath it that depend on it, which is important, because if you nuke this dependency, you would again be back where you didn't want to end up. The problem is, the dependencies may not work correctly with the new version. You do not know that. Sometimes if you install a new library, there has been an API change. So a new software that says, oh, if I call this library function, I expect the return value of 5, and the new API says, well, we are returning 2, the string. Then of course the application will not work. In order for you to know that this actually works, you have to understand that A, the API has not changed, and that the software actually works with it. That cannot always be guaranteed, which is why make replace is a somewhat risky target. But you can also delete the package. Again, remember all the dependencies, all the packages that you have installed, and then you rebuild them all. Make update does just that. The problem with that is, it is very, very destructive to your current system. Because, as I said, if you delete an essential package, one of the main libraries, like JPEG, TIFF, PNG, one of those, the entire lower part of the tree underneath it will be removed. Package source will remember what it was, it will rebuild them, but that takes a long time. Also, if you then have a package source tree that is updated, you will get newer versions of other packages. Maybe you didn't want to have newer versions of, say, game chat program, but you need to upgrade PNG. So that is one of the disadvantages here. The other problem is that during the rebuild process, the system itself is unstable. If you delete all these packages, you can't use them, obviously. The problem is, you actually have to do first the deletion and then rebuild them. Otherwise, you have no guarantee that the new software will actually work with the packages, which otherwise would be the make replace target. And what do you do if, for whatever reason, one of the packages fails and you end up without that package installed? Now, you can do that also with binary packages if you don't want to spend all your time compiling all the software. So, you again delete all the package, remember all the dependencies, and rebuild them all. So, you first store package info of what you have installed. Then, the package delete with the R flag, the package which you want to upgrade. The R means recursively delete everything that this depends on. After that, you run package info again, save it somewhere. You run a diff over it so you know what has changed, which packages need to be installed now. And then for each one of those, you have to go through and edit for binary packages. This requires you to have all the binary packages available. So you may not have all the training packets available. So how do you do that? Well, you can download all the required packages from ftp.netbsd.org, but it's often convenient for you to specify your own optimization compiler flags, for example, or to be sure that you only get the software that abides by the licenses that you set beforehand. So what you can do is you can regularly bulk build all packages yourself. Or you can regularly build only the packages that you have installed yourself. The difference there is if you say, I'm going to bulk build all packages, it means that you say, okay, I'm willing to actually build over 5,000 packages. If you have, like my laptop, 150, that's a little bit overkill. So you could say, I'm going to regularly just rebuild my 150 packages. All right, we have a framework for doing just that. So you say, take a look at user package source and paste slash bulk. What you do there is you create a file called build.conf, which requires this environment variable, so that contains certain definitions on what you want to be doing with the bulk build. And then you run this program, run this bit, mk bulk build. And then you need like a really good book, because it takes a long time. If you want to rebuild all 5,000 packages, currently we have on the fastest architectures like the Opterons, it takes about, I think, 2 days. If you're running something on a Spark or an SGI MIPS, it takes you about 2 or 3 months. So you probably do not want to do that regularly. The other problem is during this process, all packages that you currently have installed will be removed. So you cannot use that machine while you're building. What you need in order for that to do is obviously lots of RAM and CPU power. The more you have, the better. You need about 10 gigabytes of disk space for all the different files that you keep downloading all the time. You need about 8 gigabytes of disk space for the results in binary packages, and some disk space that you just use for scratch. Alright, so you say you want to have to download 5,000 different disk files. Suppose you are on dial-up at home and it works the other T1. Well, how do you do that? Well, you can actually fetch all the files somewhere else. You can run make fetch list in user package source, which will create a shell script which will download every single disk file that you need. You could then run that somewhere at work, run the result on a CD, take it home, and then you could run this thing at home if you wanted to. The bulk build does the following. It runs, first of all, the pre-built scripts. The script that updates your package source, first of all, cleans out any broken packages, any broken disk files, and removes every single package installed. The next step, it runs a bulk package with an optimized order in which packages will be built. So before it starts building, it figures out the dependency graph for the entire package source, for all 5,000 packages. It means it will first build packages that are very essential, so that later on, when it arrives at more complex packages, it already has the other ones installed for binary package. And it can just use package up instead of having to rebuild them. And then post-build afterwards, it creates a report for you and tells you what succeeded, what failed, and so on and so on. Instructions on how to do this in a sandbox are available online. And this is where it really gets interesting, because as I said, if every single thing is deleted when you begin, you don't want to do that on your regular work system. You want to do that either on a dedicated machine, or you can do it in a sandbox. You need to set up the tools where you have the regular environment, and then you go on and run this thing, and it doesn't affect your normal environment, your normal work place. There are a couple of other tools. There's this tool called package-conf, which automatically sets up and operates inside a tool. So what you have to do for that, you run package-conf, it will extract all the sets for that BSD into a certain tool, and you will specify which packages you want to compile. It will go into the tool, compile them, create binary packages, deinstall them, and leave you with a clean tool there. It's a very handy tool if you, for example, only have a handful of packages that you want to install and you don't want to affect your current environment. There's also a package check, which automatically updates packages to the latest package source version. A package check, you can create a configuration file where you just list the packages that you want to install on a per host basis. It has a very clever configuration file that says, okay, if you have the first line say .net4 and the next one says .. then it will say, okay, if my host name is .. then I will install .net4. The good thing is, this is expandable, meaning you can have one configuration file for all your different hosts that you may have for different purposes. So you can actually just list all the packages that you have and say install it on www, install it on Bozo, and install it on Foo. And if you don't want to have .net4 on Foo, just leave it out and put the other package there. And what you can then do is you run package check, and it will automatically update all the packages built them for you and just help you to set a binary package that is the one that you actually need to upload all your packages. Alright, security audit packages is the tool that I mentioned earlier, which allows you to check your installed packages against vulnerabilities, which is incredibly useful and really important. It consists of two tools. One tool is called the download vulnerability list, and it just does that. It downloads a file called package vulnerabilities, which is maintained by the NetBSD packages team. The NetBSD packages team follows, or like all other people, the bug track list, other software announcements, and said, okay, there's been a new vulnerability, so it creates the entry. It may look like something like this. For example, it may say, down here, bind 9.3 has a denial of service attack, a denial of service vulnerability, which is over there, is the explanation of what it does. If you run all the packages, and you have bind 9.3 installed, it will say, you've got a denial of service vulnerability. Take a look at this allocation. It will not do anything. It will not magically update your package. That would be a bad thing because this might not apply to you. See, a denial of service attack may be something that you do not care about because you're not a high target, or because the way that it is produced could not occur in your environment. Or you have a local file write that may not affect you as person in the user of one single workstation, not as much as somebody who actually is an administrator for a large installation. So therefore, all packages will not automatically in the background update things for you. It will send you a warning and you have to make the decision of whether or not you want to update the package, which is a good thing. There are a couple of other nifty tools that we have in package stores. Obviously, there's the category package tools in package stores. You have package depth graph, which I already used twice, which shows you the visual representation of the packages that you have. The nice thing about this is not only shows you a visual representation of what you currently have installed, you can also use the output of audit packages and flag all the packages that are currently vulnerable. So it will say, okay, if I have the output of audit packages and I run this tool, then I can say, my package PNG has a local file write vulnerability, so I mark it red in my graph, and all packages underneath it are marked yellow because if I update this one, these will be affected. So you can very easily and very quickly see what action that you might take will influence what packages. Package find. If you don't know what you're looking for, and you want to say, okay, I'm looking for a news reader, as I said earlier, you could just say package find news, and it would list all the packages that are currently in package source that relates to news. Package link helps you to check the package source entry for correctness and remove out of it just binary packages. And this can also, excuse me. Yeah. The question was, how does package find associate the keyword that you're looking for? There are different ways. It has a couple of flags. One of them says, okay, look in the comments that you have in the package. Or one of them says, look for packages that contain the file named, whatever you give it. So there are different flags, and you can specify different search criteria, and then it will look for them and say, it will then tell you, go into Nextdoor to install the routing, the onion routing, for example. Package lint is very useful for you if you're developing tools yourself, if you're developing package source packages yourself. You can use that to clean up your packages. But it was also used earlier in the bulk build to actually calculate a dependency graph for every single package on your system and every single package in package source. It takes about 10-15 minutes on a medium-sized system to run this, but after that you will have sorted out the optimal bulk build order for you. There's package startup, so if you already have a package installed, you can just create a binary package very easily without having to have package source installed on your system. So you can install this package, which will then create a binary package from whatever is installed. A couple of useful variables that you may want to set in your sdmake.com file. The first one is called ignore recommended. Now, why would I ignore what is recommended there? The reason is this. If you have packages that say, okay, I am depending on this package and I need version 5.0. And in package source, we may have 5.6, for example. And we can say in package source, any package that relies on us needs 5.0. We recommend 5.6 for whatever reason, it has a new feature or something. But if you only want what is absolutely necessary, then you ignore our recommendation, and if you have 5.0, it will be good. So you don't have to rebuild everything just because there happens to be a new version out. So that is something that if you have a large installation, you may want to set. Depends target equals package. or actually depends target equals whatever make target you can come up with. Since everything in packet source relies on make, you have different targets. You have make extract, make package, make install, all these things. But the thing is, what does it do when it runs up the dependency trees and starts from up there? So if you say, I want to have a package of this thing, then what it will do normally would be go up, install everything that is there, then go back down and make a package of this. But it would not add a package of the dependency. If you set the dependency target to package, and at the end, once you're done building, you have packages of every single one of the packages that you are needing. And you can set, for example, the master site override. So usually the master sites are set for, depending on what kind of package you have, either for ftp.netbsd.org or for wherever you download the disk file from. Depending on your geographical location, it may be pretty far from you, it may not be the fastest. If you, for example, run your own mirror, or you're at the university, you don't have somebody running a mirror, if you set your master site override to your local mirror, then you actually have much less time spent downloading stuff from all across the globe instead from 2 feet away. Very useful. A couple of the useful targets, one of them is show all dependencies. If you think, oh, I kind of would like to have a check program, and you go into check/game, and then you say, wait a second, game that probably requires all my GNOME libraries. I don't use GNOME. Do I really want to do that? You can type make show all dependencies, and it will show you every single directory of every dependency that it needs. And then you can decide whether or not you want to do that. You can say, oh, this only requires these two packages, I'll install it. Or you say, this requires 50 different packages, I'm not going to do that. And another one that is very useful, especially if you're debugging on package, if you're not quite sure if everything's going right, then you can say make show var variable equals and then the name of the variable. So if you, for example, think, oh, this fails, I should have, not have the optimization in my compiler's flags in there. I do not want to have -02 in there, for example. But you're not sure where it's coming from. So you say, okay, show me the variable C flags, and it will tell you what package source uses as the variable for that. Very helpful if you're debugging these things. There are, of course, many other targets that I could not now go into, but anyway. So what's next? What does package source do that is also exciting about the new things that we are doing? There's a bunch of areas where there's work we've done. Some of it is already completed. Others have been just merely suggested. But just a couple of ideas of where we're going. First of all the stuff, software, installing software, obviously requires you to be the super user. But sometimes people want to use the package source software as normal users because they do not have super user access on the system that they're using it. You can't actually run package source completely without super user access. You just have to set your local base to /tilde package, for example. You set your var db package here to /tilde/gb, and then everything that package source will use will install everything in your home directory, where, of course, as a normal user, you have access to. It's incredibly useful for people who do not have root on their machine but want to use package source. Now, we're currently also working on integrating that with both builds so that you can actually run the whole thing on your own without having access to root. Automated plist handling is something that the plist, as you may recall, is the list of files that are in your package. Right now, what we do is for every single file, when the person who packages the software, who creates the package, they have to actually track what files are installed and write this file from the plist to actually have the list of all the files. That is a little bit cumbersome. It would be much more convenient if our infrastructure could create these lists automatically. There might be an approach where you say, okay, first install this package into another location, and then you see what files are there, you list them, and then you make back the plist. There are certain complexities involved in that, but that is something that we're also working on. Now, as you may know, NetBSD is cross-buildable for all platforms. So you can build an NetBSD operating system on your Linux i386 or your Opteron machine, and you can create the binaries for SGI or VAX, which will take you months otherwise to compile the stuff. We have a toolchain for that. Now, the problem is that packages themselves, you cannot cross-compile at this point in time. That is, if you want to have a package for the MacBPC platform, you have to have it compiled on a MacBPC. If you want to have a package for VAX, you have to compile it on a VAX. That's unfortunate. But there's currently work being done to actually allow cross-building these, to use the possibilities of the GCC cross-compiler to actually create binaries for target architecture.
last year at EuroBSDCon in Germany, Christo Walfried's on, he is working on this, presented a talk on how to do that. It was very interesting, and I'll post a link later on to the paper, and you may want to take a bit of a read. It's very interesting to see how you can create binary packets for a different architecture. The main problem is that, as I said earlier, a lot of the software that is out there is not so well written. It means it's probably not cross-platform capable. So it involves a lot of patching the files and making sure that you are actually using the right types of data structures and so on. Recently, a couple of days ago, somebody popped up on the mailing list and said, oh, I wrote this cursor-based interface to package source, which is called Package Select, which is a cursor-based package browser. So you can actually use it on the command line, and then it has a cursor interface, kind of a GUI. I haven't looked at it yet, but it sounds very interesting. Of course, eventually you want to integrate something like this with our system store tools and all the sushi, that are our system administration tools, to allow users, once they install that BSD, to also directly say, okay, now I want to install these binary packages. That's something that we're working on. We want to be able to parallelize workloads. Nowadays, many people have clusters or have access to clusters, or maybe they only have three or four machines at home. But if you can actually parallelize it in an efficient way, you could spread out the bulk code over all these machines. That also, again, involves a lot of figuring out the correct dependencies, which package needs to be built first before you can build the other one. And then that across different machines is not so easy. But we're working on that too. And as I was writing this up, I just had this idea, wait a second, we have the checksum for every single file of every package that we have installed. Why doesn't audit packages just sometimes also include a switch to say, take a look at all these files and see if they've been modified? You are not tripwire, this intrusion detection system, where you say, okay, once you have something installed, you check a snapshot, you record checksum of every binary that you have installed. If then, somewhere in the middle of the night, you have a cracker come in and modify something and install the truth hit, then you will probably notice it the next time you run tripwire, and you'll say, wait a second, the binary has been modified, the checksum doesn't match. Since we already have the checksum for every single file on the system installed anyway, it should be triggered to extend this to include a certain intrusion detection system on that. And that's just one of the other things that just came up. So you see, there's a lot of different things that are still going on, and there's many ways that we want to expand package source. So let's see what you can do. Since we're a volunteer project, we want you to help us out. Because the only reason that sometimes a package has not been updated is because nobody had the time to do that. We are all in the open source industry here, so we rely on other people to help us do our work. So one of the first things is you may want to join the tech package mailing list, where we have some discussions about our infrastructure. There's a project on SourceForge, which is called Package Source Win. It's the Package Source Work in Progress. It allows people who are not NetBSD developers to create binary packages, or to create package source packages, to include them, and then later on to review them with other people, and several NetBSD developers review them regularly. And if they say, okay, this one is now ready for import, they will import it into package source proper. We now have several, I think almost 1,000 packages in work in progress that are currently extending our own package source team. And since everybody can join SourceForge, every one of you can actually have CVS commit access there and help people build more packages. If you are interested in a piece of software that has not been packaged, create one. We have very detailed information on the website on how to do these things. We have a detailed guide, which is similar to the NetBSD guide, it is our package source guide. And you can just read through that and figure out how to create a new package. Or you can say, wait a second, there's a new version out of my new favorite software, it's not in package source. Sometimes it's as easy as modifying the version number and creating the checksum for the disk file. If that works out, do that, send us a patch. Look at the PR database, the problem report that we have, and say, wait a second, I fixed it on my system, somebody else might use that. Look at that, send us patches. Or, if you have another operating system where you have not brought the package source to, and you'd like to tinker around with these tools, port it over. It should not be very difficult. We have developed the NetBSD compatibility library, which should compile on pretty much any Linux operating system. So if you get that to compile, the package tools should be able to link against that and install. And then you have a new platform to port it. And of course, we have a file called .todo, where you can find other ideas if you want to help us out with all these things. And there's a couple of links for you and a couple of references to the manual pages. And that is all I have to say. So if there are any questions.
Any questions?
No problem.
How portable will this be, in fact, of course, to other BSDs?
Yeah, it has been ported to all the major distributions. Just go back to one slide where we have all packages. There we are. This is the list of platforms that we currently support. So as I said earlier, PBS and OPBS we have already been ported and are working fine. The only problem there is that we have to be careful not to overwrite the native tools. Like we have package ads and PBS has package ads. So we have to set the path accordingly. But otherwise, it's already been done. And the Brain 5 USB project might be looking into using all our software too. So. Other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much.
I just have one dumb question. I'm just curious, what about the previous report system? What do you think initially gave?
The PBSD post collection, I mean, that was way before my time when NetBSD started to use the package source collection. But it just turned out that there were ways that were done in the PBSD post that were different than in the NetBSD package source collection. And under NetBSD, we have always said, okay, we want to make this work on all of our platforms, most of all, so we have to patch a lot more. We always contribute our patches back. I mean, I'm sure the PBSD people do it too, but I don't know for a fact. That's not what we do since I don't have much experience with PBSD. And then, of course, we started actually becoming cross-platform compatible, and we wanted to keep going that way. And, we started out with Solaris and then Linux, and as far as I know, we're the only software package management system that actually supports this number of platforms and this number of packages. There's this project called Open Package, which has some 500 packages, and they're available for Linux and BSDs and macOS or something like that. But that's nothing compared to our 5,000 growing and all the platforms, so we're very happy with that. Well, as I said earlier, if you pick a package manager, you pretty much have to stick with that one. Because, of course, our package system cannot say, oh, you have installed this software from this other package manager. So, for example, if you have already installed Perl, which is the OpenBSD part of the base system, but not NetBSD, the package source collection will effectively install it from package source because it cannot reliably know that what version is coming in the base system is actually compatible with the packages that we have. So that's one of the problems. If you want to make a switch, you have to dedicate enough to say, okay, I'm going to switch my system over. You cannot say, oh, I want to be able to use my JIT library from RPM on the Linux system with the open source, with the package source. Yeah, I probably would. I mean, I've been using package source on JetBSD, obviously, on Linux, on Darwin, and I ported it over to Iris, and I've been using it on Iris for a while, and especially on Solaris and Iris, I very much recommend it. Just because the number of packages that are available for those platforms is far lower than what we have. So it's actually very nice to also be able to have the same interface to your software manager. Hi, thank you.
What?
He said that Solaris works very, Solaris works very great. It actually is trivial to use. As I said, basically what you have to do is if you have an internet connection, all you have to do is type make install and it will do all the things necessary for you. The difference to, for example, the apt-get is that it's on binary. But of course you can also use the package add-tool and install binary applications using the same mechanism. And I think it is totally comparable to that. This package manager is not installed for default on Linux systems or other systems. It is for default on NetBSD, of course. I guess I'll go over here. But if you want to install it, you can install a binary bootstrap kit for it, which you can download, or you can build it from scratch also just from this one tarball. You just download it, go into the directory, type make or type bootstrap, and it will build all the tools that you need and set you up right away. Yes.
Talking to this deciding whether or not
the major number of the shared library, that was the question. So that at Debian, people often debate whether or not they have to increment the major number of the shared library. That is a similar problem that we have in Package for 2 that just every open source software system has. At some point, you are changing the ABI. And if you do that, you have to make sure that all other software knows that it has changed. And if it has changed, that software probably needs to be revoked. So if you change the major number of the library, that means that all other software that has been using the previous library will probably not work. The question is, when do you change, when do you bump this number? We have something similar which is called the build link, which is our mechanism to figure out dependencies among packages. And this is where the ignore recommends thing comes in. What we now do is we show you two values. We say, okay, if you want to use this package, this functionality provided in this package, you absolutely need the version required. But we also have now in package shows the newer version, which is called, is a higher number. If you want to use that, you can use it, but we only recommend this one. But you absolutely need this one. It's very difficult to strike a balance between these two of saying, like, when is something really required, especially at the basic libraries, because it requires a rebuild of all the other ones.
That's
correct. I mean, this is something that more applies to the base operating system. Like when you, for example, when does NetBSD bump their libc major library number? It's a similar question. But as for package source, it is a similar comparable problem that you actually have to see when do you bump something causing the rebuild of all the other things. Yeah, exactly. So you are facing the same problem. For example, if there is a security issue out for a library, at some point you just have to face it, suck it up, and upgrade it, because if it's a security issue, at some point it will bite you. But you can't always allow the user to make the choice and say, well, this is what it provides, you have to make the choice yourself.
You mentioned that Dragonfly supports you by using the
person who ported package source over to Dragonfly BSD is, I believe, the Dragonfly BSD developer. He sent the patches to our tech package mailing list, and from the Dragonfly package, Dragonfly users mailing list or whatever the name of this is, I know that there have been discussions about using package source or not. They have been talking about using the previous reports collection, or developing their own system from scratch, or using package source. There has been some talk, and we hope that they go all the way, because it would make for a great... Yes, that has been recently. Sun has expressed interest in using package source, either internally for their company's purposes, or also to a combination with Solaris 10. And as I said, they have just donated two machines for the tours to the NetBSD Foundation, just for the express purpose of making package source work better on Solaris. Solaris X86 and Solaris I386, Spark.
Now, the root of my question is, has anyone else approached you? Because even though it works on all these, they don't use them.
Yes, no, that's true. That's of course, the problem. The main problem is that as a volunteer project, we scratch our own itches. You know, if somebody says, okay, I've been using it, like, for example, I've been using IRIX, and I was not happy with the way software installation worked there. So I started to import it and install it myself using package source. That is how most of this works. We are very glad now to see that Solaris has expressed interest in it, and that Dragonfly BSD has expressed interest in this. There have been many Linux users on the mailing list that have said, oh, finally we have a package software management system that actually works. So we are very glad about that feedback, and we try to approach other people and make package source more widely known.
Is your ambition to?
Well, yes, no. We definitely mean, just like any free software, we just want our software to be used. So it's not that we say, oh, we don't want this evil company to use our software. We're glad if they use our software, then it's useful. So we're very happy about that. So, as I said, for Sun, we're looking forward to hopefully a collaboration there. All right.
Nice.
Quick. Just one question. Oh. Okay, question. It turns out we apparently have a couple of giveaways, and I was approached to come come up with a quiz to quiz you if you actually paid attention to my talk. Of course, I have no question that actually come to my mind, but one of them was, what is our prices? We have...
We have gift certificates for the computer book works.
So, if you pay careful attention, let's start with an easy one. Let's see. Name an operating system that package source does not work on. Oh, who do we pick?
Anybody but him.
Right. Yeah. 3.1. Well, that starts. Even though the Windows family. Well, can you select some 3.1? I'm not sure. Let's see. How many do we have there?
3.1.
All right.
If you wanted to install package source.
Okay, hold on a second. I'm just going to unplug this so I can look for my slides.
While he's doing that, I'm going to ask one that's pretty simple, pretty easy, so he's on the spot for an answer. If you wanted to install package source, what's the first thing you do? Back in the corner, Jesse.
Get the bootstrap.
Get the bootstrap. I think I would agree with that, yes.
Yeah.
There you go. Let's see. Command can you use to figure out to get a visual representation of the dependency graph? Correct. All right. Somebody's paying attention. All right.
Download.
All right. Let's see.
RCFM.
So you've got two more?
One more.
One more. Oh, only one more. Okay, we've got to make this a hard one. What's the name of the package that I used as an example? Okay, that wasn't so hard, but still. Yeah, wait, here. Yeah. Well, you
know.
Thank
you. That was helpful.
Again, we're just making our way to Denison, which is on the
house to the before, I would have come up with,
73?
I shouldn't be anticipating John. 73 Thompson. So it's my responsibility.
So you make your way out the door, you make your left on Thompson, you go down to 73, you see BT on the west side of the street. On your right, but...
Okay.
Thank you.
My pleasure.